Live from the nation's capital, President Joe Biden and comedian Colin Jost headlined the White House Correspondents' Dinner. See all the biggest stars together in one room live April 27th at 8 p.m. on CNN and streaming on Max.
We've been listening to President Biden in Pennsylvania, kicking off a tour of key battleground states only hours after his fiery State of the Union address last night. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I want to go straight to our senior White House correspondent, MJ Lee. She's on the scene for us in Wallingford, Pennsylvania. That's outside of Philadelphia. MJ, the president is working to build on the momentum he appears to have gotten from his speech last night. Set the scene for us. This is just the start, right?
That's right, Wolf. We just saw the president's post-State of the Union tour officially get underway. Both the president and the first lady, we heard, echoing some of the themes and the very issues that we heard from the president's speech last night on everything from protecting democracy, reproductive rights, and lowering costs for everyday Americans. But unlike last night, Wolf, it was really interesting. We heard President Biden referring to his predecessor, but this time multiple times by name, using very stark language. Wolf, last night we heard from many of the president's supporters basically saying that they saw a version of President Biden that they had badly wanted to see. They saw vigor, they saw clarity, they saw energy, and they are now hoping that President Biden can take all of that and replicate it as he travels the country. Now, to that end, we know from the campaign that the president is going to be doing a flurry of travel in the coming days, traveling to states like Georgia, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And we're also going to see the campaign beefing up its operations even more, opening new offices, launching a new ad campaign. Basically, everything that we see the campaign do from this point onwards is going to be with an eye towards November and with Donald Trump in mind, as we clearly saw from the president's speech just now on the stage. Now, just one last thing that I do want to note from where we are here in the suburbs of Philadelphia. We are seeing every day, Wolf, signs that the issue of the Israel-Hamas war continues to be a big political complication for this president. As we were coming into this gymnasium, we spoke with a protester who said she is here because she wants to call on the president to back a permanent ceasefire. Now, of course, as you know, the president has so far only called for a temporary ceasefire. And we saw him telling reporters just moments ago that he's not hopeful that a deal can be struck on that front by the time that Ramadan comes around this weekend. Well,
all right, MJ Lee on the scene for us in Pennsylvania. Thank you, MJ, very much. I want to bring in our CNN political commentator Scott Jennings and Karen Finney, along with Biden biographer Evan Ostos, who's here with me in the Situation Room right now. So what do you think, Evan? You know President Biden. You've written a terrific biography of him. You recently spent some time with him in the Oval Office for an article you wrote, an important article in the New Yorker magazine. Does he believe his message is resonating right now?
Yeah, I think you're starting to see the outlines of what the message is going to be. We heard some of that last night, and just now we're seeing what is going to be really the thrust of this. In the very foreground, there is going to be talk of abortion every day. You know, there is a real feeling in the White House that they know this resonates with people. They're very concerned about losing that access to and losing a right that has been established for 50 years, the threat to democracy. And then also, these day-to-day issues, things like price gouging, things like junk fees. I know it can seem like these are two very different kinds of problems. They see them as generational challenges on the one hand, and then real practical day-to-day issues. You put these things together, and it's important to add, you make a joke or two about your age, you invoke it as a sign of wisdom, as, you know, I remember when we were more decent to each other in public life. That's a formula we're going to hear a lot over the next few months.
What did you think about the fact that last night he really went after Trump, but he didn't refer to him by name. He only referred to him as my predecessor. But today it was Trump, Trump, Trump.
Yeah, I think last night it was Biden's night. You know, of course, it is an official speech. There was a heavy political element, but, you know, he was there to talk about what it means to be the president of the United States. This was a campaign rally. There he is out on the road. He's talking about the man he is going to be running against, not the man who he replaced and drove out of office the last time. So
interesting. I stand by. Karen Finney, it seems to me, based on what I'm hearing from a bunch of Democrats out there, they were pretty pleased by what the president did last night. I think they're going to be pleased by what he just did now in Pennsylvania. What are you hearing?
Absolutely. I did some checking in today with particularly some of the groups, the outside groups that are supporting the campaign, and they were very pleased. And it was a big win. And as you can imagine, folks need to win. I mean, in a campaign, you need to feel like you are clear about why you're doing it. You support your guy is out there fighting and you're fighting for him. I think particularly they were pleased. We saw in dial groups overnight, some of the internals showed independents, Democrats and Republicans really resonating, particularly with this economic message. They also, obviously, modern campaigns, you've got to be, you know, in the digital space. And so different clips they were testing from the speech did very well, particularly when we talked about, he talked about Social Security, reproductive rights, as Evan pointed out. Also, towards the end, when he talked about the future. And so to what Evan said, you are going to hear more about that because, again, the testing is showing that is resonating with people. So I think you're going to both see and hear more of that.
And in the hours after his speech, during his speech, in fact, as well, his campaign was raising a lot of money online.
Yes, they were. And obviously they've been doing very well in fundraising, despite what the polls might say. And again, last night, I think that's another sign of how well it was received.
Very interesting indeed. Scott Jennings, do you think President Biden has been able to surpass the very low expectations set by Republicans in his remarks today and last night? Did they set the bar too low?
Well, he thrilled Democrats. I mean, he gave a campaign rally speech instead of the State of the Union, and he just gave another one today. And yeah, I mean, I think Democrats are thrilled. I mean, you can hear it all day long. Last night, Democrats are very happy. What I wonder about, is the rest of the country happy with it? Are middle America swing voters happy with it? I haven't heard from a single Republican who thought it was a very good speech. And so I think he really was scrambling last night, frankly, to convince Democrats that he's still got enough juice to run this race. It sounds like maybe Democrats think that he does. My personal view is that a lot of the people who have driven down Joe Biden's job approval would have rather heard him spend more time on some of the issues they're worried about. I mean, he's obsessed with Snickers more than he is obsessed with the southern border. And I don't know if they're going to be able to run a whole campaign on Snickers bars, but I guess we're going to find out because he did it again today.
He repeated what he said last night about shrinkflation, as he's calling it. Let's talk a little bit about the whole nature of his speech. It was a fiery, very strong speech last night as well as today. Why haven't we heard these kinds of speeches from him over these past several months?
You know, I think there's a rhythm to a campaign. I mean, over the last several months, I've been talking to the White House a lot. They were watching the Trump battle in the primary against pretty weak opponents, but that was, you know, they were essentially letting that play out because there was going to come a point when it was going to be a Trump versus Biden fight. And if you go too early, you start making speeches like this, it diminishes the impact of it on a night like they had last night. They're not going to have a larger audience than they had probably until the convention. So you have to pick your shots and pick them right.
And he picked last night as tens of millions of Americans were watching on television, the broadcast networks, the cable networks, everybody was taking it live. It was a very serious moment indeed. Do you think, at least among Democrats, he put his mental capacity, the issues that had come up, to rest?
Absolutely. And just to respond to Scott, again, what we were seeing internally in dial groups, independents and moderate Republicans were resonating with what the president was saying. So I think it was a win all around. You know, it was interesting to note sort of the vigor in his voice, particularly, Evan, after reading in your piece about the sound of his voice, I think there was some, they were conscientious about really projecting strength and confidence. And again, you saw that today. And I think people like, you know, that's what feels like a campaign. And I think people like to see that.
What do you think, Scott?
I don't think there's any Republicans that heard much in that speech last night that are going to cause them to say, yeah, let's do four more years of what we've really hated about the last 4 years. I think that's totally bogus. And I think, though, we are going to see an extremely partisan, nasty campaign. The speech last night and the speech today, I mean, it's really all about Trump. I mean, Biden's main pitch is, I'm not Trump, and here's a little bit of Democratic boilerplate thrown in. Trump is the center of this universe. Biden obviously thinks that by scaring people with Trump, that's how they're going to win the race. I think you're going to see a really, really, really negative, nasty campaign out of this Democrat. And obviously, you're going to see one out of Trump, too.
You know, it's interesting, Evan. The February jobs numbers came out earlier this morning. 275,000 new jobs created in the United States in February alone. All these other economic numbers that have been coming out, the Dow Jones, the NASDAQ, you know, people's 401ks, unemployment, they're very, very strong. But he doesn't seem, at least now, at least in the most recent polls, to be getting any credit, significant credit for that. Why?
You know, you're beginning to see some shifts on that. Consumer sentiment has been rising over the course of just the last 6 weeks, 2 months. There was actually a poll of business executives recently that says that they're seeing conditions improve. It takes a while for this stuff to trickle into the populace. You know, I think it's worth responding to something Scott said, too, which is, was there anything in that for on a bipartisan basis? Look, there was an opportunity for Republicans to cheer the idea of pushing back against Vladimir Putin's aggression, to cheer the idea of cutting drug costs, cheer the idea of going after abusive practices by corporations. There are opportunities there if they want to do it. After all, the biggest example is a border bill, which passed the Senate 70-29. So it is sitting there if Republicans want to take
and
it up.
It was supported by conservative Republicans
in
the Senate, indeed, and is just laying flat in the House of Representatives. Republicans won't put it up, largely because Trump told them to don't give President Biden any victories right now for political reasons. Everybody stand by. We're going to continue to watch what's going on. President Biden voicing deep concern about Donald Trump's meeting tonight with the far-right Prime Minister of Hungary, a strong man and an ally of Vladimir Putin. Let's go to CNN's Kristen Holmes. She's in West Palm Beach, Florida, not far from Mar-a-Lago, where Trump is hosting Hungary's Viktor Orban. Kristen, tell us more about this meeting.
Well, I do want to tell you one thing, because I was listening to Biden speaking just now. Hearing him really go after Orban was quite striking for somebody who has sitting in a number of speeches of Donald Trump's and usually hears the former president praising Orban, saying how much they are aligned, saying that Orban has really done wonders with his country. And then hearing Biden essentially calling him an authoritarian, saying that he wants to take away democracy. Just a very interesting juxtaposition, particularly, as you said, because Orban is currently meeting with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. The two of them were set up for what one advisor called a social meeting. The idea there being that there was no agenda, that this wasn't some kind of formal sit-down meeting, which, of course, in some ways it couldn't be because Donald Trump is not currently a world leader. But one thing to note is that the White House never issued Orban any sort of official invitation to come to Washington to meet with Joe Biden, and Orban never reached out to the Biden administration to sit down with anyone from the administration or with the president himself, which gives you an idea of where Orban's head is at. It also gives you an idea of where Donald Trump might align himself if he is, in fact, brought back to the White House. The reason why this is so significant is because Donald Trump is not just the former president, but he is currently the presumptive Republican nominee. And this really gives you a look at what a Trump second term might look like in terms of a world stage. Donald Trump has repeatedly, as I said, praised Orban on the campaign trail. And on top of that, the two of them seem to have the same political playbook. They are almost identically aligned when it comes to immigration. They have both said that Putin wouldn't have invaded Ukraine if Donald Trump was still in the White House. They have both attacked a free press and called it fake news. There is a lot of similarities there to point out. So whether or not we have an agenda for this meeting, it is telling of what the next several months and possibly another Trump administration would look like.
Kristen Holmes in West Palm Beach, Florida, not far from Mar-a-Lago. Thank you very much for that update. And there's a lot more news we're following, including more breaking news. We'll take a quick break. Much more right after this.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life,
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with the breaking news. President Biden ramping up his attacks on Donald Trump in the key battleground state of Pennsylvania just hours after delivering his fiery and very political State of the Union address last night. The president kicking off a tour of crucial swing states, including Michigan, where he plans to campaign next week. Joining us now to discuss what's going on, Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell of Michigan. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us. The president, in these remarks, repeatedly took on Trump by name this time as opposed to last night. He's touting his record on the economy, reproductive rights, and health care. Does that resonate, do you believe, does that resonate more than his arguments about protecting democracy here in the United States and around the world?
So I think it's going to be all of them. You know, today was a political speech. Last night was the official state of the union speech. So that's why you saw the more direct naming of the person today. I think being worried about what's going to happen to our democracy, treating each other civilly is an important issue. But there are a lot of different groups that are going to matter that have to show up in November at the polls. Women are going to be the biggest. In Michigan, 2 years ago, when abortion was on the ballot, had one of the highest voter turnouts we've ever had. We need to turn out women. A lot of the economic discussions he's having right now, we've got to get in the union halls. We've got to talk to those workers. These are issues that are going to resonate with them as well. And they've got to get to the polls. So these are very, very important issues in terms of some of the people that have to vote in November.
As you know, the president seems to be dialing up his public rhetoric against the way Israel is conducting its war in Gaza against Hamas and resorting to plans to deliver aid to the Palestinians in Gaza by air and sea. Is that too little, too late for the 101,000 people in Michigan who actually voted uncommitted to protest the president's policies?
So, first of all, Wolf, I'm going to remind people that we're a state that often votes uncommitted, though the number was higher. And the community called the campaign Listen to Michigan. And they did want to be heard because so many members of the Arab American Muslim community have lost members of their family, have members of their families they can't get out that are struggling. There's no food. There's no medicine. We need to get significant humanitarian aid there. Quite frankly, I was disappointed to hear today that we are not likely to get a temporary ceasefire by Ramadan. And that temporary ceasefire needs to go into a permanent ceasefire at some point. People are hurting here. And until they don't see any more children dying, until they don't see the innocent loss of civilians, it's going to be hard for them to have some of the real conversations and the comparison that's got to be made and will be made at the right time.
Yeah, let's hope there is a ceasefire and it happens soon. The United Auto Workers president, as you know, Congresswoman Shawn Fain, was one of the First Lady's guests at the State of the Union address last night. How far does the president's economic message go with rank and file union workers in Michigan, where you are?
So Shawn Fain and I have talked a great deal about this. He has endorsed the president. We know we've got to get into the union halls and really talk to members about what the president's done. And it's one thing to say, OK, today we had 85,000 new jobs. They need to understand how much he has helped them. And they are. Look, let's be real. There are a lot of working people across this country that have felt the effects of inflation. But they are beginning to see things are costs are coming down. We have to make it very personal to them. And I'm not going to kid anybody. We've got to get into the union halls. But the Joe Biden you saw last night, the Joe Biden you've seen today, he connects with these workers. And I do believe that I was worried about the union halls in 2015 and 2016. You know that. I think that this Joe Biden is one that will connect with the union workers.
And we'll see what happens in Michigan, a key battleground state. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, Donald Trump just posted a nearly $92 million bond for the E. Jean Carroll defamation ruling, but he still owes hundreds of millions of dollars for other cases. We have details. That's coming up next, right here in The Situation. Tonight, we're tracking Donald Trump's enormous cash crunch from multiple legal judgments, fees, and penalties. He just posted a nearly $92 million bond in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case against him, and that's just a drop in the bucket. He's on the hook right now for Mega Millions. Brian Todd is taking a closer look.
They attack my business. I built a great business. But
the former president's projection of himself as a star businessman with deep pockets facing a stern challenge tonight. Donald Trump today posted a bond of nearly $92 million to cover the damages in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case as he appeals the judgment against him in that case. An insurance company called Chubb underwrote the bond Trump posted today. But Trump still owes damages of $454 million for a separate judgment against him in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case. And while he's appealing the case, he's only got until March 25th to pay that off.
He's in a really big bind, particularly because there's a clock ticking on it. It's a very tight timetable. I mean, someone with that wealth might be able to raise cash if you give them enough time. But with this kind of situation, it's very hard.
Another hit, he's been ordered to pay $385,000 in legal fees to a company he sued in the Christopher Steele dossier case. And he's got other mounting legal fees that he owes for litigation in the four criminal trials he's facing. All of this raising questions about Trump's ability to pay.
This has got to be really straining his finances. Donald has always had a house of cards financial structure.
The former president's finances are an opaque, complicated tangle. Forbes estimates his net worth at about $2.6 billion, but most of it is tied up in real estate. Could he sell one or more of his famous properties to cover it?
That's hard to sell real estate very quickly, unless you're doing a fire sale on the assets, which you wouldn't want to be doing.
Could he spend campaign money to pay the New York civil judgment? The New York Times recently reported that one of Trump's political action committees spent about $50 million in donor money last year to pay legal expenses for him. But because that New York civil case was not related to his campaign or his conduct as president, he likely wouldn't be able to use his PACs to pay that judgment. He could sell his stake in his social media platform, Truth Social. A pending merger between the parent company of Truth Social and another firm could make Trump's stake worth about $4 billion. But
if this company can even merge to go public, he would have to wait 6 months to be able to sell anything.
That raises another possibility.
I think Donald may file personal bankruptcy as a strategic move to delay collection of these cases. His goal would be to get past November 5th, the day of the presidential election.
One other hurdle Donald Trump is facing is that some of the world's biggest banks actually stopped lending to him a while ago. Wolf?
Brian Todd reporting. Brian, thank you very much for that report. Just ahead, what President Biden is saying about a potential ceasefire in Gaza as the fate of hostages hangs in the balance. And I'll get reaction from a New Jersey couple whose son was kidnapped during the October 7th attacks.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Tonight, President Biden says efforts to secure a pause in the fighting and a hostage exchange by Ramadan are, in his words, looking tough. This as talks for a six-week ceasefire between Israel and Hamas stall before the Muslim Holy Month begins early next week. Joining us now, Yael and Adi Alexander. Their son, Idan, was kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th. They attended President Biden's State of the Union address last night in Congress. They were guests of the New Jersey congressional delegation. Yael and Adi, thanks to both of you for joining us. Our hearts go out to you. How do you feel, first of all, hearing today that President Biden is casting doubt on a hostage deal, it seems, anytime soon, after he promised to get this done as soon as he could during the State of the Union address?
We're hoping that the deal will be executed. I think it's a great deal. It's on the table. It could be behind us days ago, but our understanding that Hamas walked away from the table, and that's the situation right now.
I know you had a chance to meet also with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, on Wednesday. What did you hear from him, Adi? Did that conversation give you hope?
Yeah, we meet with Jake almost on a weekly basis, and just to show us the commitment of the administration and to give us a little bit of the updates of what is going on. But whatever were discussed in the private meeting, I could not share, but most of it, it's out in the news right now.
Yael, as you know, Israel is demanding that Hamas provide a list confirming which hostages are alive. Have you gotten any information at all on your son, Idan's condition?
No, we didn't get nothing. It's 154 days. It was 5 months yesterday since October 7, and we don't know anything. What about like Idan's situation there? He didn't get the medication that we asked them to get him, like nothing. So we don't have any new info.
And we know he turned 20 years old, in December in captivity, right?
Right, at the end of December, it's December 29th, it's his birthday. So it was the first time since October 7 that I flew back to Tel Aviv, and we've done some celebration for him. I thought that if he could hear us, like on the news or the radio station or whatever, and knows that the family and friends, everyone is loving him so much. And I just, you know, I hope that maybe he heard something.
Adi, what worries you the most as this war enters a sixth month without a deal to free the hostages and stop the fighting?
I think we need to implore all the our local players and our partners, Qataris and Egyptians and Israelis as well, not walk away from the negotiation table. Just, it was 5 months and enough is enough. The ceasefire deal is on the table and we need to execute it.
Well, let's hope for the best. Our hearts go out to you. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. We'll continue this conversation to be sure. And coming up, efforts to airdrop aid into Gaza turn deadly as a parachute malfunctions. What it says about the ongoing struggle to respond to an exploding humanitarian crisis in Gaza. A deadly setback in Gaza tonight in the ongoing struggle to provide desperately needed humanitarian aid. Video obtained by CNN shows an airdrop of aid going very, very wrong when a parachute malfunctioned and the contents fell at a high speed toward a residential building. At least 5 people on the ground reportedly were killed, 10 others injured. I want to bring in CNN's chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward. She's joining us from Jerusalem right now. Clarissa, does this underscore how badly the aid delivery system is failing the people of Gaza?
Oh, there's no question, Wolf. And there's still a lot of questions here. We don't know exactly what nationality that aid drop was. The U.S. has said that all of their bundles were safely delivered today. So it could be, a different nationality. We just don't know. But as you say, really, this underscores the absolute tragedy and, frankly, the impossibility of trying to effectively deliver aid relying on things like aid drops. We heard from one humanitarian official who said, quote, airdrops are good photo opportunities, but a lousy way to deliver aid. And that's why you've seen, I think, Wolf, President Biden trying to establish a new mechanism, building a pier to allow the U.S. to deliver aid directly to Gazans by sea. But as we heard today, that could take up to 2 months. And those are 2 months, Wolf, that Gazans don't have. And again, aid workers saying even the pier, it's a glaring distraction. The best way to deliver aid is on the ground, but you can't deliver it properly and effectively without some kind of a ceasefire in place, Wolf.
And we saw something very disturbing today. And you were there. You saw it in person. You saw some Israeli protesters attempting to block aid going from Israel into Gaza. Tell us about that.
So, Wolf, this has been going on for over 6 weeks now. It's a group called SAV9. It's made up of some settlers and former reservists, but also ordinary families who believe fervently that all the aid that gets into Gaza is going to Hamas, and that there is a better chance of getting hostages out safely if they completely cut off aid from getting in. Now, we've seen Israeli authorities who had been kind of turning a blind eye to these guys taking a much tougher line and preventing them from actually crossing into the area where the trucks are entering into Gaza. But still, these protesters are going on a regular basis, spending hours trying to skirmish and outmaneuver the police. And what's interesting, Wolf, is according to a recent poll done by Israel's top polling institution, the Israel Democracy Institution, some 68% of Jewish Israelis believe, as these protesters do too, that international aid should not be able to get into Gaza, Wolf.
Clarissa Ward reporting for us from Jerusalem. Clarissa, thank you very much. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. The news continues next on CNN.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.